It's the Amazing Rico Bronya podcast with your host, Evan Roberts.
Rico Bronya, welcome to episode 702 of the Rico. We will discuss the New York Mets getting walked off in the wee hours of the night, Monday into Tuesday, against the Seattle Mariners by a final score of 3-2. We do this, Rico Bronya, the day after. And I'm not going to reveal who, because that's not important. All I'll say is one of us, either me, your humble host, Evan Roberts, or Pete Hoffman, one of the two of us fell asleep and was unable to do the Rico Bronya. Now, you can guess on your own. It'll be like a trivia game you can play by yourself. But one of us fell asleep. Who was that? That's up to you to decide. Look, losing on the West Coast sucks. I couldn't sleep last night. Oh, wait, I guess I gave that away. My apologies, Hoff. You know we love you. When you lose on the West Coast, this has been true my entire life, and I think most Met fans' entire life. When you invest hours to stay up late and you lose on a walk-off in the bottom of the 10th inning, it's very difficult to just put your head down on the pillow and go to sleep because you start to kind of go over all the little things that went wrong. Now, this game didn't feature that many of those. So what I mean by that, for those that didn't watch the game and you're using this Rico Bronya almost as a recap of Mets Mariners on a Monday night, is number one, their defense was actually really good. A.J. Ewing continues to play a stellar center field. Carson Benj made a great play in right field. Brett Beatty looked outstanding at third base. So overall, the Met defense was really good. Overall, their pitching was really good. The offense just didn't do anything. Like, it was one of those games where they get the two solo home runs. Jared Young goes left center to break up the perfect game by Emerson Hancock. And then Marcus Semien, who's been red hot lately, drills a home run. But outside of that, the offense didn't get anything going. So there wasn't a rally for you to get frustrated about. There wasn't a, hey, you got a runner on second, nobody out, you didn't advance the runner. I mean, they did do that in the 10th inning. We'll get to that later. But through regulation, through the first nine innings of this game, there was none of that. I mean, they were essentially mowed down. Emerson Hancock did whatever he wanted. He actually retired the first 12 guys he faced, and there was that slight thought of, are the Mets actually going to get perfected here? Are the Mets going to get no hit in the middle of the night against the Seattle Mariners? But obviously, they were able to break that up with the two solo home runs, like I mentioned, by Jared Young and Marcus Semien, but they didn't do anything offensively. So there wasn't a lot of, hey, that was really frustrating. Hey, how do they not advance that runner? Hey, how do they not drive that runner in? They never forced Emerson Hancock to even work from the stretch. It was frustrating, a different kind of frustration, because you just want to see this offense get going, and they were unable to do it. They were unable to draw a walk. What was crazy about this game offensively is outside of MJ Melendez being hit by a pitch to start the eighth inning on a 2-2 pitch that I still wasn't even sure actually hit him, but I guess it did because there was no challenge. Outside of the hit batsman of MJ Melendez, the Mets didn't have a base runner. I mean, obviously the home runs count as base runners, but you know what I mean? Getting a guy on first base, getting a guy on second base. They didn't have any. The next time and the only other time that there was a guy on base was when it was mandated in the top of the 10th inning. So offensively, and we can start there, and honestly, we can end there, because it is very difficult to win a baseball game when you only get three base runners and two base hits. Like, that's tough to do. Can you win a game? Sure, your pitching needs to be flawless and nearly perfect, and that was certainly not the case. But offensively, it was the same old, and there's a lot of people to blame. Bo Bichette has cooled off. You know, Bo Bichette was showing a sign of getting hot and changing his season around. It hasn't happened. He takes an 0-for-4 yesterday, and I think we need to, I don't want to say start the conversation because I think the conversation's been going on. I think we need to amplify the conversation on if Bo Bichette should remain as the number two hitter. Like, why should he mandated or why should he be mandated as the number two hitter? Why? Because he makes a lot of money? Why? Because his resume is really good? I mean, he hasn't hit. We're talking about April, May, the first day of June, a few days in March. We're talking about over 2 months now of a guy hitting 218, or now it's down to 216. He just hasn't been good. And I'm not saying you bench him. because they don't exactly have better options. But I think we have entered the world now where Carlos Mendoza's got to give serious thought to not batting him second. Where do you hit him? Who bats second? It's a different discussion. I'd probably just move everybody up a slot. It's not like A.J. Ewing is lighting the world on fire. He struck out two more times and took an 0-for in this game, and his batting average is dipped now pretty close to where Bo Bichette is. So I don't know if the answer necessarily is A.J. Ewing. The answer may just be, because of his hotness, Marcus Semien. And I mentioned this the other day to Hoff, and I think we all have to do this as Met fans, is you can't let your preconceived notions or how you feel overall about Marcus Semien impact the right now. The right now is he's playing really good baseball. And that's good for us, no matter what you think of the trade or what you think of the player. So because of that, I think the answer could just be flipping Bo Bichette and Marcus Semien in the batting order. You reward the veteran player in Semien for performing, and you tell Bo Bichette, I don't care how much money you're making, you got to be better than this. And I've got some emails I want to read about this, so I'll let them go into more detail. But I'll just say on the surface, the other guy who you look at last night and say, you've got to be better, is Juan Soto. And that may seem unfair because Juan has hit so much recently, and he has. He's been red hot, hits the Grand Slam on Sunday. It feels like he's hitting a home run every other day. But what Juan Soto is lacking, and it's backed up by the numbers, is clutch hitting. It hasn't been there. And when he comes up in the 10th inning with a runner on second and nobody out, and he is facing a lefty, and still there's that possibility that you just don't face Juan Soto, and you face Mark Vientos instead, and you try to get him to roll one over and bounce into a double play, and you don't let Juan Soto beat you, which is now the second time we've seen an opposing manager with a base open in extra innings say, I'm going after Juan Soto. And think about what happened both times. Soto failed. Right before MJ Melendez hit the game-winning home run on Friday, they faced Juan Soto. What did he do? He flied out meekly to center field. On Monday night in Seattle, same thing. Dan Wilson says, I'm going to go after Juan Soto. Do I agree with that decision if I was the opponent? Probably not. But for the second time, it worked. And it worked because Juan Soto, more so this season than last year, is really lacking the big hit. And it's just backed up by the numbers, the late and close numbers, the two outs and runners in scoring position numbers, the numbers in extra innings. I mean, they're all right there. It's not me making it up. And you felt it in Monday's game. Because when Juan Soto comes up with a runner on second and nobody out in the 10th inning, you're gifted that base runner because of the Manfred rules. You didn't earn it. You didn't put a guy on second base. It was given to you. And you've got your best hitter up. And you've got the opposing manager allowing Gabe Spire, the left-hander, to go right after him. At the bare minimum, and this is the bare minimum, you have to advance him. And instead, Juan Soto strikes out. He actually struck out almost twice, because one time he struck out, but luckily it was a ball and it got overturned. Let me read this email from John about Juan Soto. So I'll put it in the perspective of some of our listeners. Juan Soto is a great hitter. We all know that. Do I want him on my team? Sure. Did I want the Mets to sign him? No, not the point or relevant here. Last night's game, Monday night in Seattle, is an example of when you really need your star players to do some heavy lifting, or just some lifting for that matter. Frankly, I'm a bit tired of Soto not coming through when it matters most. We can't afford to lose winnable games like this if there's any hope in pulling a 2024. Not that I'm optimistic of that happening with this team. He gets paid to be the guy. Go be that guy. This doesn't mean big numbers on the back of the baseball card. It means being a solid player overall. He has been more clutch this year, but watching him every day, if I knew nothing about names, I would say he's one of the best hitters on the team. I know. Look at his numbers, though. They're good. Watching every game, I'm shocked they're as good as they look on paper. Rant over. Let's take two. I would actually disagree with you in terms of him being more clutch this season than last season. It feels like, even though he didn't get off to the same bad start, and he obviously missed time due to injury, it actually feels like he's been worse. And you look at the ninth inning numbers, and you look at the extra inning numbers, and you look at the two outs and runners and scoring position numbers, it's just bad. Now, the good news is, and I said this a lot last year, but I really mean it. The good news is, I still trust Juan Soto. Like, what I'm doing here, and I think what John is doing here, is we're describing our frustration about the way he's playing, but it doesn't mean we don't think he's a clutch player. It doesn't mean we don't think he isn't capable of becoming red hot and carrying this team. He's done it before. I know we don't like to count what happened elsewhere, but he won a World Series as a 19-year-old. He pushed the Yankees over the finish line in 2024 when they won the American League pennant, including that amazing at-bat in Cleveland in Game 5. I can't ignore that. I know what his resume is. I don't think the moment is too big. Certainly a game in June in Seattle isn't, you know, swallowing Juan Soto whole, so it's not like I'm worried long-term, but I think John is right. The Mets are 8 games under .500. They are not in some great position. These games are very important. These are swing games. These are the games that are the difference between getting back into this race and not getting back into this race. And they had a chance to win last night. And they didn't. And a part of why they didn't is because their best hitter went 0-for-4 and did nothing. And when he came up in the 10th inning with a runner on second base, he struck out. On the other side of things, I do want to talk about the pitching. As far as the strategy is concerned of using an opener, I was in favor of it with David Peterson. I thought it made sense. And, you know, based on Seattle's lineup, you look at J.P. Crawford and Julio Rodriguez and Josh Naylor and Randy Arozarena and Luke Raley, who Dan Wilson was going to start either way. I guess you get to avoid Arozarena and Julio by using the opener. But I would just start Sean Manaea. And Sean Manaea is stretched out to the point where he's thrown 60, 65, 70 pitches, right? That's what he's done this season. So it's not like he's Tobias Myers. He can throw between, you know, just based on what he's done so far this season, between 60 and 75 pitches. That's kind of been his range when the Mets have used him as a long man. So starting him, I don't think is that big of a difference based on this Seattle lineup. Now, you did have Austin Warren get to face Rodriguez and Arozarena. And I guess you do that so Manaea doesn't have to face those guys a third time around. Well, if you look back at when Manaea faced them, he only faced them once. So he wasn't even allowed to face them a second time around, which gets back to kind of my issue, which was why Manaea was taken out. Sean threw the ball really well. And I don't want to gloss over that because he's pitched a lot better. His velocity is up. His command has been better. He made the one mistake to Cole Emerson. That was it. And, you know, you're allowed a mistake. The problem is the Mets offense gives you no margin for error, but he makes the one mistake to Cole Emerson. And outside of that, it was great. He pitches a 1-2-3 sixth inning. And when the seventh inning is coming up, and he just got Julio Rodriguez out, so he faced him twice, I thought, because you're looking at the lefty in Naylor, you're looking at Arozarena, who he only faced once, and you're looking at another lefty in Luke Raley, I thought it was a nice zone for Manaea to come out and pitch the seventh inning. After the game, Carlos Mendoza, and I guess this is one of the benefits of not doing the RICO immediately after the game, because sometimes when we do it immediately after the game, we don't hear from the manager and hear his reasoning for things. So Mendoza was asked, you know, why did Manaea come out? Like, were you thinking of allowing him to stay in the game? I'm going to raise my hand and tell you, I wanted him to stay in the game. I'm making that very clear right now, especially since they used an opener. And there were two lefties coming up in the seventh, including one right-hand hitter who he'd only faced once in Randy Arozarena, which is a part of the perk of using an opener. At least that's a small part of it. And Mendy said two things that it's not as if they're not true, but they're not, like, fully as true as he said it, if that makes any sense. Number one, he said, well, look at the pitch count. You know, Sean Manaea threw 62 pitches in this game. He hasn't really thrown that much more than that. Okay, let's pull up his game logs, why don't we? Now, let's fact check the manager when he says, hey, look at the pitch counts. He hasn't really thrown that many more than the 62 that he threw. So Sean Manaea threw 62 pitches. In his previous outing on May 26th, 5 days ago, he threw 68 pitches. So in the same range, but he threw more. In his outing before that, 4 days earlier, he threw 65 pitches, which again, kind of in the same range. He had a 57-pitch game and then a couple of shorter games, 20 pitches and 17 innings. But before that, against the Nationals on April 29th, he threw 73 pitches. Before that, he threw 61 pitches. Before that, he threw 72 pitches. And then two other games in early April, he hit 74 pitches and 70 pitches. He's kind of stretched out, Mendy. Like, Now that you're basically inserting him into the rotation, even if it's as a bulk guy, he's hit the mid-60s in his last two appearances. He had thrown over 70 pitches four times this season. So it's not when he says, he's not used to throwing that many more. I mean, again, it's not true. But it's also not as if he has topped out at 50. Like, you're telling me he couldn't have gone to 70 pitches in this game? Where you allow him to start the seventh inning against Josh Naylor, who he had retired previously, and go batter by batter and kind of see where this game goes with a pitch count of 62. So the pitch count thing didn't really and doesn't fully add up. I wouldn't say it's a lie or it's completely BS. I just think when you hear the numbers I gave you, you can come up with your own interpretation. Maybe you're going to agree with him and say, well, Ev, he hasn't really gone well beyond that. The times he got to 70 was much earlier in the season. That's why I want to give you the information and let everybody else decide. The other thing he said was that, well, you could tell his velocity was down. That's what he said. All right, let's take a look at that. Let's go to the bottom of the sixth inning. He threw 89.5-mile-per-hour sinkers and a 90-mile-per-hour sinker to get Colt Emerson out. When he struck out J.P. Crawford, 89 on the sinker, 91 on the sinker, 91 on the fastball. So low 90s, and then 90 on the fastball to Julio Rodriguez. If you go back an inning earlier, just to put it in perspective, it was a touch up. He was at 91.4 on his fastball to get Mitch Garver out, 91.6 on a sinker, 90.4. So it runs into the same thing where he's not lying to you, but there's a very small difference in terms of the velocity. It's not significant. You're talking about the difference between 91.5 and 90.1. So it's about a mile per hour down, which again, you tell me, is that enough to say, hey, that velocity's down enough, I got to get him out of the game? To me, it isn't. It just isn't. I would have pushed it a little bit more with Sean Manaea. With that said, that doesn't give an excuse for Brooks Raley to fail. Brooks Raley's been a different guy over the last few weeks. Who knows why? This is a guy who's been unbelievable since the Mets brought him back from Tommy John surgery. He was having a great year this year. And one thing Brooks Raley doesn't do often is give up home runs. So when he gives up a leadoff home run to Josh Naylor, it's odd. It's not normal for him. But bottom line is he failed. And he was actually very lucky to get through that seventh inning. The next batter, Randy Arozarena, hit a ball to right field that kept going and going and going, and Carson Bench had to make a nice running catch. He did strike out Patrick Wisdom, the pinch hitter, gave up a base hit to Cole Young, and then you saw Mendy have to go to Luke Weaver to clean up the inning. Luke Weaver did a really good job. Another great defensive play by A.J. Ewing in the eighth inning, and Devin Williams did a great job. What was impressive about Devin is that he had an eight-pitch sequence against Julio Rodriguez and beat him with a fastball up, and it was a battle. J-Rod kept fouling pitches off, and Devin Williams won it, fell behind Victor Robles, who somehow came into this game after Naylor hit the home run in the seventh inning, came back from 3-0, and Brett Beatty made that great play, that kind of suicide scoop, if you will, on a ground ball that was hit to third. Then he struck out Randy Arozarena. So the Met bullpen, at least the Weaver and Williams part, did a great job of keeping the game tied after Brooks Raley failed. But I didn't love the Manaea decision. And I think that, even though Mendoza never said this, it bothers me sometimes that when you're going to use an opener, which sometimes I get, one of the perks of using an opener is that getting five innings out of your starter or six innings out of your starter allows you to go even deeper into the game because you've already stolen an inning by using a reliever. Well, for that to kind of work in my mind, for that to be beneficial in my mind, don't you have to take advantage of the extra inning you're getting from your starting pitcher later in the game? So Manaea was capable of going six. He threw five innings. He threw 62 pitches. We just went through the pitch counts. We went through the velocity. Getting another inning out of him allows you to go straight to Luke Weaver and Devin Williams. Allows you to go, hey, dare I say, straight to Devin Williams if Sean Manaea pitches really well in that seventh inning. And I feel like sometimes with managers, they're addicted to the inning. They see it's the seventh inning. It's like, oh, I got my formula. I got my relievers I have to use, so I'm just going to go to them. Well, you don't have to do that. You don't have to do that. you got to stick with, is the pitcher pitching well? Now, obviously, Mendy gave different reasons than that. So this is more me surmising that I think managers do that, maybe subconsciously. They don't admit it. And Mendy did not admit that. I take him at face value. Velocity was down. The pitch count. We laid it out for you. You decide. I disagree with it. You decide. But it does feel sometimes like managers are addicted to using the formula. The formula failed. So am I frustrated with Brooks Raley? Sure. I mean, sometimes you got to pick up your LD offense and pitch really well and get those last night outs and get a victory. And that would have been a great victory. Winning games in Seattle right now, especially the way they're playing, that would be great wins. That would have been an awesome win on Monday night. And I said this at the beginning of this series, in the beginning of this road trip. I'll reiterate, if you didn't hear episode 701, just get me 500 on this road trip. The Mets are facing a step up in competition, and as much as they need to cut in to the deficit that they're in, being under 500 and certainly the wild card race, if you want to look at that, to me, it's more they're this amount of games under 500. I think against opponents like this, with the pitching they're throwing out there, just survive it. And getting a win on Monday would have been a big help in surviving it. Unfortunately, they were unable to. Let's get to some of your emails in reaction to Game 1, thericob@gmail.com. This is labeled Monday Night Disaster, courtesy of JD. JD writes, Evan, the Rico B might be the only reason I still watch the Mets at this point, so I can follow along with what you're talking about. As I sit here at work at 1:36 in the morning thinking about the abomination of an offensive performance I just had to sit through, I can't help but beat a dead horse. Mark Vientos needs to go. Obviously, in this game, we needed him to come up with a big hit. He does the Vientos thing and strikes out. With Jared Young looking decent and the rumblings of a Jorge Polanco return on the horizon, I don't see Vientos having an impactful role on this team. His offense is inconsistent at best, and his defense, well, I don't say that I need to say more. I think using Vientos as a possible trade to help with starting pitching could be a viable option should an opportunity arise. Now, I can't lie. I'm a little biased towards Vientos ever since he followed his instincts and got thrown out by a mile at home plate. That situation, coupled with the selfishness of using a challenge when the outcome was inconsequential and his readiness to swing at the pitch that hit him in the leg or 8 inches outside, really makes me wonder why we're continuing this experiment. Thank you to Hoff and you for trying to keep us sane through this abysmal season. I am not going to defend Mark Vientos because I think all of us are kind of at a wit's end. But the way I feel about Mark Vientos right now is that while his at-bats are going to dwindle, not only with Jared Young being back and Jared Young contributing, hitting the home run in the fifth inning, and Jorge Polanco coming back, I still think he has a role on this team, and they kind of need him. And that's a weird thing to say, but he is a guy, despite only having 7 home runs this season, which really only puts him out of pace for, you know, 20, he still has capabilities that they need offensively. Jorge Polanco is a walking injury. There is no confidence level that once he comes back, he's staying healthy. Jared Young is still trying to prove himself to be a major leaguer. Mark Vientos is a more accomplished major leaguer than Jared Young. So I am not defending Vientos. I'm not telling you I believe in Vientos, but I still think they need him. And based on the injury histories of Polanco and the uncertainty of Jared Young, it would not stun me if there's another moment where Mark Vientos has run out there every single day. But will he lose at-bats? Yes. Should he lose at-bats? Absolutely. They have other options right now. John writes, this is another bad Mendoza game. Let me preface this by saying you cannot expect to win a baseball game when you have 2 hits. However, taking Minaya out after he had retired, I think 9 straight, and was completely rolling to bring in Brooks Raley, who's another lefty, who has not been sharp recently in a game where you probably aren't going to score another run, was extremely dumb. Also in the 8th inning, after Melendez got hit by a pitch, I felt like that was a very obvious spot to pinch run with Vidal Brujan, and ended up costing them as MJ was unable to avoid the tag in the double play that wiped out the inning. It just seems like Mendoza is always watching a different game. So let me start on the back end with the MJ Melendez pinch runner situation. The only thing you have to keep an eye on there is, A, I'm not sure Vidal Brujan is going to run. Like, he's going to try to steal a base, which there's a value to. Because if he's going to do that, and you probably need him to steal a run. But if he doesn't try to steal, you're gaining a little bit of an edge in terms of sprint speed. but not enough when you look ahead to the fact that in the 10th inning, potentially, that spot in the order was going to come up. And if you use Vidal Brujan, it's either Brujan or Wagamon getting that at bat in the bottom of the 10th inning. So you do have to think a little bit ahead in regards to, all right, I am getting an advantage with speed, but if that run doesn't come across, if I'm still tied two innings later, what am I doing offensively? Melendez was on deck when A.J. Ewing popped up to end the 10th inning. That double play, though, was very weird. I don't even know why there was an argument. Interference was called, and you know, Daniel Murphy made a great point how he doesn't like the rule that it's the base runner's obligation to get out of the way when he's just running in a straight line. But he was tagged out. He ran into the tag. So who cares if it's interference or not? Like, it doesn't matter. But that was a killer because you get a gift from the gods when MJ Melendez is hit by a pitch. And when Brett Beatty hit that chopper off the bat, I thought, all right, they're going to at least advance the runner to second, and we'll see if Marcus Semien can continue to be Mr. Clutch. And it obviously ran into an out. I've addressed the Mania stuff. I disagree. We laid out what Mendoza thought, the facts behind it in terms of velocity, in terms of how many pitches he's truly thrown over the last few weeks. But I'm with you. I disagree with the move. Jordan writes, this is a bad loss. Not being able to even advance the runner in the 10th with Juan Soto leading off is so bad. He has just not been good in those spots. And what a waste of disengagements for A.J. Minter when it looked like Randy Arozarena was going nowhere. Free stolen base after the second step off. Yeah, that is a big, big moment in this game. So obviously after the Mets don't score in the top of the 10th inning, I think we're all assuming the worst case scenario. A.J. Minter comes in, key spot for A.J. Minter, and he strikes out Patrick Wisdom. So right off the top, he does what's necessary, which is make sure that the leadoff man doesn't advance the runner. But you're right. A.J. Minter twice in a row wheeled around to step off to keep Arozarena close at second base. Now, Randy is a threat to run. Let's not act like he isn't. But once he steps off a second time, you're giving Arozarena the free rein on that 3-2 pitch to take off. And there wasn't even a chance to throw him out. And so the buzzkill of you did your job by striking out the leadoff hitter with a runner on second. By the way, take that statement and put it back 20 years. Imagine if someone just came from a time machine and said, did that guy just say struck out the leadoff hitter with a runner on second? What? Anyhow, I guess we have to get over this. The rule is here to stay. But you completely defeat the excitement of the strikeout by Arozarena stealing third base. Then you've got the options of, do you face Cole Young to get to Dominic Canzone? Do you actually walk both of them to get to Mitch Garver and load the bases up and give yourself a real opportunity at a double play, slower base runner, and a force at every base? I was very mixed in this moment. I've given you strong opinions on the Mania poll and all those kinds of things. I didn't know. It was kind of a pick-your-poison spot. You bring the infield in, and you hope A.J. Minter, left on left, can just get a big out. Unfortunately, he didn't, and it was bad luck because it was a broken bat bloop, but the bad luck was created by A.J. Minter's two step-offs that allowed the runner to get to third base. Joseph writes, imagine staying up for extra innings on a West Coast game and having to work the next day just to watch this LD offense. Not fun. Not fun. Yeah, it was a frustrating loss. And now they're going to be asked again to face a very tough pitcher. And they're going to go bullpen game again with Waskar Brazoban into Jonah Tong. Find a way to get a win in Seattle, get two wins in San Diego, and get back to New York still somewhat alive, not in a bigger hole than you went into. That would be my view. One other thing non-related to this game, the Francisco Alvarez rehab is incredible. So Francisco Alvarez, who went down with that torn meniscus not that long ago, we all figured he would be out for months, is already set to begin a rehab assignment, which is incredible. Say what you want about Alvarez, and we've said plenty. He is injury prone, no doubt about it. But one aspect of his injury proneness is his incredible ability to come back sooner than a normal human being's timetable. So Kudos to Alvarez. The hope is when he comes back ahead of schedule, he stays back and he's productive. Luis Torrens, I think overall, has done a pretty good job. He'll run into those clutch hits every once in a while. He did have a miscue yesterday in which he had Randy Arozarena thrown out in the second inning. Like, he was going to be thrown out by a mile and unfortunately made a rare bad throw. Luckily, it didn't turn into anything because Rob Refsnyder bounced in with 5-4-3 double play a couple of pitches later. But Torrens is a backup catcher. That is his ideal role on this team. And I also think that Francisco Alvarez has developed a great rapport with some of these pitchers. We've tried to figure out the issues with Nolan McLain, and maybe having Francisco Alvarez back, the connection they have formed, maybe that'll be a big help for Nolan McLain. So great news around Alvarez. Hopefully he'll be back soon. Same with Lindor. I mean, that's really the hope. The outsider long shot hope on saving this season is surviving, getting healthier, specifically with Lindor even more so than Alvarez, but sure, why not both of them? And having a lineup start to morph into something that's competent. Because right now, it's not a competent lineup. You know, we could love what we saw Saturday and Sunday against Miami. What we saw on Monday night in Seattle is pretty much what they are. It's pretty much what they've done most of the season. You want to tip your hat to Emerson Hancock and a very good Mariner bullpen? Sure, you can do that. But the track record's the track record. The Mets have played 60 games, and they've mostly been a terrible offense. So move Bo Bichette. Flip Bo Bichette, Marcus Semien. Why the hell not? And see if that works. We appreciate you downloading the Rico Bronya. I always say subscribe because you never know when we're going to give you an instant reaction, or in this case, a next morning reaction to one of the individual games. But at the end of every series, of course, we give you the Rico Bronya with the I'm the Man Right Now and the Net Negative. So make sure you've subscribed and you'll never miss an edition. Thank you very much for listening and hanging out with us on another sad edition of Rico Bronya.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Rico Bronya podcast. It's amazing, isn't it? Make sure you download it now to keep it on you at all times.